You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The five-year anniversary of the Iraq invasion is drawing near, and next year a new administration will move into the White House. Iraq will be a major issue in the upcoming election. Should we stay with an aim to winning in the end? Should the coalition admit defeat and pull out? And if we leave, how soon can we do it? In his latest book, Defeat, Why American Britain Lost Iraq, award-winning journalist Jonathan Steele argues that George Bush and Tony Blair actually lost the war from the day they decided to occupy the country, and that the best option is to get out now. His book is published by Counterpoint, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jonathan Steele to the show today. Hello.
Hi.
Since you're a senior foreign correspondent and in-house columnist for international affairs for The Guardian, have you covered the war from the beginning?
Yes, I've been about eight times since April 2003. And I noticed, I must say, within the first few days of the invasion and the toppling of the statue of Saddam, that Iraqi attitudes began to change. Most people, of course, were very glad not to have Saddam anymore in charge. But this so-called liberation very soon turned in their minds to occupation. And they were wondering, you know, why are the Americans and the British still staying here now that they've toppled Saddam, now that it's clear there are no weapons of mass destruction? There must be some other kind of agenda.
Well, how long did you think this thing was going to last?
Well,
I had no idea. At the beginning.
Like you, I must say, I thought the thing was a mistake from the beginning. I mean, I thought it was both illegal because it didn't have UN Security Council backing. I thought it was unnecessary because Hans Blix and the UN inspectors were in there. They'd only been in there 4 or 5 weeks. Obviously, one has to give them time. It was a big effort to get Saddam to accept them in there, and he let them in. Well, let them work once he's done that.
Now, you, in fact, in your first chapter, you include a sample of graffiti from the pedestal where Saddam Hussein's statue once stood in Baghdad's Firdous Square. It said, "All done, go home." Now, the done was misspelled by, I don't know if people still misspell English these days, but that was the feeling. Okay, you came in, you got rid of Saddam for us, now let us take care of our own business.
Exactly. That was very much the mood. I mean, I went on this huge march that happened within about 3 weeks or so of the invasion when all the Shia marched to Najaf and Kabbalah. It's the famous Arba'in ceremony, which takes place every year. And it was the first time, of course, they'd all been allowed to walk in public. Under Saddam, they had to take back roads or go in vehicles. He didn't want huge crowds congregating on the streets. And I think for most Iraqis, that was much more the symbol of the new Iraq than the toppling of the statue. They saw these literally hundreds of thousands of Shia marching in the street. And I, you know, interviewed people. It was very easy to talk to them. And the overwhelming comment I got from people was exactly like, "All done, go home." It was, "Thank you for getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Now go. Goodbye."
Well, you say one of the biggest mistakes the American forces made was in their unwillingness to interact with ordinary Iraqis. So some reporters like you were then. I suspect it's a lot more difficult today. But why were they unwilling to interact? Was it because the violence escalated pretty much from the beginning?
Well, no, I think the violence took a long time to get going, actually. I think it was a kind of mindset, almost a xenophobic, racist mindset, and also a feeling that, you know, maybe there could be somebody shooting at us. And so that really alienated Iraqis very soon on. You know, there were these convoys of Humvees that would go down the main roads in Baghdad, and people would have their weapons pointing at the crowds. People thought, wait a minute, they say they've come to liberate us. They're treating us as though we're enemy.
And American soldiers placed an American flag on the pedestal.
They did do that. I mean, that was really one of the major blunders, completely misunderstanding. And I think
it wasn't Mount Suribachi.
Yeah, they're just misunderstanding the nature of Iraqi nationalism.
You also include in that first chapter, which you've called Iraq Without Iraqis, that there was a joke that circulated among Iraqis shortly before Prime Minister al-Maliki met with George Bush in Amman, November 2006. And the joke was, question: what would the U.S. president be demanding? Answer: a a timetable for Iraqis to withdraw from Iraq. Right. That seems like a pretty dark joke. Is that really how the Iraqis perceived America's role in their country and continue to?
Well, I think they felt the Americans just despised and rejected them, if you like, and just thought they were incompetent and hopeless. And somehow, if only the Americans, you know, the feeling was the Americans must have a dream that if only they could wake up one morning and there wouldn't be any Iraqis there creating problems. And even now, when you look at the way the Bush administration talks about the Nouri al-Maliki government, which is supposed to be its ally, to all this talk about benchmarks and so on, sort of implying they're kind of school kids who've got to sort of produce a decent grade before they're going to get a pass.
But they haven't done things that would reassure us, have they, that they can really handle it without a major bloodbath?
Well, I think that's a very, very difficult point. But, I mean, Iraqis have certainly made a mess of some of the things. But I think the Americans also bear a certain amount of responsibility for this sectarian conflict. But that's not really essentially the point. I mean, the Americans are occupying, and the British too, a foreign country. And people want to know when they're leaving. And as long as they remain there, and ultimately the sovereignty of the Iraqi government is very, very circumscribed, very limited, it's an insult to the dignity of an ordinary Iraqi citizen.
Well, you were talking about to the Iraqis. What about, were you talking also to American soldiers and British soldiers? Were they actually expressing the kind of xenophobic thing that you were talking
about? Well, I remember one time when I was embedded and talking to some of these young officers in their sort of late 20s, early 30s, and they were pretty smart. I mean, I remember one of them that made a great quote. He said, talking about the relationship with between the Americans and the Iraqis, he said, you know, you can't really start a marriage with a rape.
Mm. So he saw it very much.
He saw it very clearly, and I think a lot of the other ones did. And in fact, the polls that have been taken among serving American personnel show that a majority of them want to leave Iraq. They understand the situation much more than the politicians in Washington, I think.
My guest is Jonathan Steele, senior foreign correspondent and in-house columnist on international affairs for The Guardian of England. He's written a book called Defeat, Why America and Britain Lost Iraq. It's published by Counterpoint. Well, we have this fifth anniversary of the invasion approaching, and the troop surge is hitting its first anniversary. The White House has been framing the surge as a strategic and military turnaround.
Well, I mean, I'm old enough to remember Vietnam and the famous phrase of General Westmoreland about light at the end of the tunnel. I think this administration is sensible enough not to repeat that particular phrase, but the tone of what they're saying now about the surge is certainly exactly in line with that Westmoreland comment, the idea that we're now beginning to see success and we must hang in there and success will flower like a garden in the spring. I mean, it's the same stuff.
Well, aren't you at all heartened by the drop in sectarian violence over the past several months?
No, of course I am. I think it's a wonderful thing, and people in Baghdad are feeling much better now than they did a few months ago. They can send their kids to school, they can go to the market, they just feel much more relaxed. But it's still, first of all, it's still not anything like normality. There's still something like 1,000 civilians being killed in Iraq every month. But more importantly, in terms of the administration's argument, is that there are at least three other reasons why the death toll of civilians has gone down in this really welcome fashion. And they are, first of all, I think that the Sunni resistance people, the national people, have now begun to work with the Americans rather than against them, because, of course, al-Qaeda is in there. In a way, Iraq's been subject to two invasions. The first one was the British and the American one, 2003. The second invasion was the 2004-2005 invasion by al-Qaeda, all these jihadi militants coming in. And the Sunni tribal sheikhs and local leaders in Anbar province have now decided that the lesser of the two evils are the Americans. The greater evil is still al-Qaeda. And they want to work with the Americans against al-Qaeda, and so there are far less attacks both on the Americans and on Shia civilians in Baghdad while they focus their energy on al-Qaeda.
Well, defenders of the Iraqi policy say that we have to stay in Iraq because we have to fight al-Qaeda. Critics say, well, I think Osama bin Laden said, well, al-Qaeda wouldn't be there if we hadn't invaded Iraq. But now we have the reality of the situation, don't we?
Yeah, al-Qaeda is certainly in there. That's undeniable, and they're in huge force. It's obviously much easier if you are a jihadi militant and you want to kill Americans. It's much easier than coming to New York is to just simply go to Iraq, and you've got plenty of Americans there. No, so they're certainly there in a big way, but it's wrong, I think, to assume that the only people who can fight al-Qaeda are the Americans, as I've just been saying. The Sunni tribal sheikhs and imams and so on and the national resistance have turned against al-Qaeda. It's a tough call for them because they're taking a massive risk. A lot of these Sunni leaders have been assassinated by al-Qaeda for their switch in policy. But the other point is that once the Americans are seen to be going, and it's clear they are going, then the whatever rationale there is for the al-Qaeda people to be in Iraq, to say we've got to kill the Americans, we've got to push the Americans out, all that will be happening. So it'll make it much easier for the Iraqis to turn al-Qaeda, say, we don't want you here. You're foreigners, just as much as the Americans. They're leaving. Now you leave too, please.
Well, is the increase in the number of occupying American troops with the surge incompatible with the Bush administration's stated goal of establishing a democratic sovereign Iraq? Because some experts feel that the president's reluctance to bring any more troops home is due to a long-standing policy that would ensure protracted American occupation in Iraq.
Well, I think that's clearly what the neocons want to do. They always wanted a long-term occupation of Iraq, and I don't think they've given that up. And they've always said we are going to have permanent military bases. And, I just see no change in policy. It's gratifying, of course, that the two Democratic contenders both say no American bases. So I think that's a huge step forward.
On the other hand, at a recent town hall meeting in Ohio, Senator John McCain, the presumptive Republican presidential candidate, said he supports a protracted American presence in Iraq, and he suggested that the situation might be analogous to the continued American troop presence in South Korea now, 50 years after the conflict there ended.
Well, I think that you've touched on a very important point, because I think the template that the Americans had, and Paul Bremer, who was the first kind of U.S. overlord in Iraq, the first year of the occupation, he saw the template as indeed an Asian one, Japan, not so much South Korea, but Japan, and also Germany in 1945. And those two occupations, of course, didn't have any resistance, neither passive nor military or armed. But, the South Korean thing is quite different. South Korea is a very divided country. There's a huge North Korean army. There is no proper peace treaty or armistice even between the two sides. And so it's South Koreans definitely feel threatened by North Korea, and they welcome an American presence. Not all of them. I mean, there is a nationalist feeling, of course, in Korea too, and some people would like them to go. That's quite different from Iraq. Iraq doesn't really, the Iraqis don't see such a threat from its neighbors that it needs a huge American presence to protect it against. The president of Iran is right now on this very day in Baghdad, showing that relations between the Iraqi government and Iran are pretty good, even though the relations between Iran and the U.S. government are hopeless.
Well, the feeling is that we need the troops there to protect Iraqis against themselves. As many people say, if we withdrew now, that would lead to chaos. But you write with a very different view, ending the occupation is a precondition for political reconciliation inside Iraq, the best chance for persuading Iraqis to look into the abyss and see they cannot afford to tear the country apart is to make them realize their country's future is in their own hands at last. As long as foreigners take Iraq's decisions for them, there's little chance of progress. But that's the optimistic point of view, isn't it?
That is the optimistic point of view. But I don't know, there's something, I suppose, about maybe it's about modern journalism or modern political commentating, that people can make all kinds of political pessimistic scenarios, and that's sort of de rigueur, that's normal, and it's and sort of realistic. If you come up with an optimistic scenario, you're somehow treated as though maybe you're a little bit naive or idealistic or something. Why should we think that Iraq is necessarily going to break down into civil war, that is more likely than that Iraqis will come together once they realize they're about to be able to run their own country? I mean, I think the neither people supporting my line or the opposite line can actually predict the future, but I think the arguments in favor of a withdrawal are overwhelming to my mind.
Before we go to a break, I committed an inadvertent faux pas earlier, the sort of thing that Barack Obama's supporters are very upset about. I sure did not intend to say Osama when I meant Obama. My guest is Jonathan Steele, whose book, Defeat, Why America and Britain Lost Iraq, is published by Counterpoint. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jonathan Steele, who's senior foreign correspondent and in-house columnist on international affairs for The Guardian. He's written a book called Defeat, Why America and Britain Lost Iraq, and it's published by Counterpoint. We got a comment from a listener, and this is something that we've heard quite a bit. Michael from Inwood says, we're losing Iraq because we never should have. Oh, no, Gary from Manhattan says, we didn't lose the war, we lost the peace. There's a difference. Since we wrecked the place, we have a moral obligation to fix it. Walking away would be immoral and would allow al-Qaeda to claim victory. Both are unacceptable.
Well, I think first I'd like to deal with the losing the peace argument, because that is an argument that is very commonly heard, and it's certainly true that the occupation people made some big blunders at the beginning, like dissolving the Iraqi National Army, like failing to stop the looting and to protect public buildings and so on.
And not protecting the infrastructure.
So they certainly made any blunders. But I think you've got to kind of break down this argument about losing the peace very carefully, because it presupposes that there was a way of having a successful occupation, that if it only it had been more efficient, more intelligent, more sensitive, better managed, you could have had a successful occupation. And my argument in this book is really to challenge this conventional wisdom and say there is no way in the 21st century that a Western army can occupy an Arab country without running up against feelings of resistance, dignity, honor, which makes it impossible. I mean, the Israelis have been trying to occupy the West Bank of the Jordan River for 40 years, and they're still meeting resistance. And this invasion by the British and the Americans was perceived as a kind of second Western occupation of a big Arab country.
Well, one of the theories behind the invasion was that we would bring democracy to the Middle East and set up a model state that then would have an impact on all of its neighbors. You're saying that would have been impossible?
I think that would have been impossible, because people don't like to be lectured to. There's a long history of Anglo-American intervention in the Middle East, so that any new occupation was bound to raise suspicions and resentment again. I mean, the British were responsible for the first 50 years of Iraq's modern existence in occupying it. Then the Americans came along and have been intervening in the Middle East for the last 50 years, sort of replacing the British in their role.
Wait. Tony Blair played a major role in this invasion.
Oh, he
certainly
did.
We didn't replace anything.
Well, no, he didn't. But, I mean, I'm talking about, the role of the Americans in Egypt, the role of the Americans in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, if you like, before the Shah was toppled, and in Lebanon. So the British were the old imperialists, and the Americans then came along and kind of inherited that imperial agenda. But I'd just like to come back to one of the points that your listener, Gary, I think, raised about the moral imperative of remaining there, that it's the sort of you broke it, you fix it argument. Well, I think it's, if you've got a faucet that's leaking in your kitchen and you get a plumber in, and after he's been there half an hour, the kitchen is under 3 feet of water, you get a new plumber. You say, this guy can pay for it. You broke it, you pay for it, but I'm getting a different plumber. And that's the point, really. The British and the Americans must certainly make a huge financial contribution to the reconstruction of Iraq, but other people have to be in charge, and ideally it has to be the Iraqis, no foreigners at all.
Not even any neighbors of Iraq?
Because
that's what's happening in Africa, where some countries resist having Europeans come in because of the legacy of colonialism, but their neighbors have been sending in peacekeeping armies.
Yes, I don't think the direct neighbors should come in, because certainly there are issues about Turkey coming in. There are issues, obviously, if you had Iranian troops coming into Iraq, Saudi troops coming in Syria. No, I think if some kind of foreign peacekeeping force was necessary to replace the British and the Americans, I think it would be good if it was Muslim countries. The Arab League should help to get them together, but not
so North Africa, maybe in Jordan,
Indonesia, Bangladesh, Malaysia, other countries. I don't think it's necessary. I mean, the Iraqi National Army has actually been built up. That's true. It's undeniable. The Bush administration has played a role in building up the Iraqi National Army, and I think they can handle it. The crucial thing is get the politics right and get that in the hands of Iraqis, take it out of the hands of the foreigners.
Now, Britain has had a long history of problems, not only in the Middle East, but in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Why do you think Tony Blair was so eager to go along with George Bush on this one? Or, in fact, in some cases, the Bush administration has quoted the Blair people as the ones who provided all the intelligence that would have led to an invasion.
Well, there was the thing about importing uranium from Niger, and that was shown to be nonsense, and that was reliant on British intelligence. So I think you're right that the Americans relied on British intelligence. Unfortunately, the intelligence was wrong.
There's that 10 Downing Street memo.
The 10 Downing Street memo. But coming back to your point about why did Blair do it, I think two reasons. I think the broader issue is that he felt that there's a strategic interest for Britain to be allied with the United States when an issue of war and peace comes up. I think he just feels that's important. We have to remain the closest international ally of the United States, the so-called special relationship. This distinguishes Britain from the continental European countries. I think that was a kind of strategic choice he took. Of course, it's not historically been the choice of other prime ministers. Harold Wilson refused to send troops into Vietnam when he was pressed to do so, and he didn't take that decision. So it's not that Blair is following a long line of prime ministers. That was just his particular view.
Actually, it is more reminiscent of what happened with the Suez Canal invasion.
Exactly. And the Suez thing, Eisenhower told the British to get out. I mean, we went in there without properly informing the Americans, and we were humiliated because our strongest ally told us to get out. But the other issue about why did Blair do it, and it is something that is debated a lot in Britain, and I think it's to do with the Kosovo War. If you like, Blair lost his military virginity in Kosovo. He feels that war was justified. He was one of the main proponents of it. In some ways, I think he feels he persuaded Bill Clinton to go in there. Obviously, Madeleine Albright played a huge role. She was very engaged emotionally and so on in that issue. But perhaps Bill Clinton wasn't so much. And Blair feels he persuaded Clinton to go in, and so I think he almost got a sort of messianic idea in his head that if he detects a principle is right, a moral issue is dominant, and that you have to take military action to stop some kind of humanitarian tragedy, his judgment is good, and sometimes the Americans don't see it the same way, and he'll tell the Americans what to do. And I think that's what he was doing throughout 2002 with Bush. Of course, they wanted to do it too, so he wasn't in any way a lead role, but I think he was certainly reinforcing Bush all the time.
I'm talking with Jonathan Steele, who's senior foreign correspondent and in-house columnist on international affairs for The Guardian. He's been with the newspaper since 1965, and he was the only English-language reporter to reach Mikhail Gorbachev's prison dacha during the August 1991 coup. The subsequent interview he gained with the Soviet president won him the London Press Club Scoop of the Year Award. He travels frequently to the Middle East, and he's been covering the war in Iraq since its inception. He's written a book called Defeat, Why America and Britain Lost Iraq. It's published by Counterpoint. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The cost of the United States so far has been 4,000 U.S. soldiers at least dead, 60,000 more wounded. Financially, it's running to $275 million per day, which averages out to $4,100 per household every day. And we can project costs going way into the future decades because of all the things that will happen with taking care of veterans and the wounded and all sorts of other things that just are the consequence of any war. What about Britain? Has it suffered in any way similarly?
Oh, yes. The initial projections that Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Finance Minister, Gordon Brown, made have been now overtaken by 10 times. We spent 10 times more in Iraq than was originally budgeted for. Obviously, our contingent is much smaller, and right now we only have 2,500 troops, so the costs have come down dramatically. But, oh yes, they completely got it wrong.
You point out that although most European nations still had embassies in Iraq before the war, both the United States and Britain didn't. And while those other nations didn't want to go to war, the U.S. and Britain did. Do you think that the U.S. and Britain were totally out of touch with what was going on in Iraq?
Well, it was very hard to get proper intelligence. I think very few people had real agents on the ground, so the sort of human intelligence was lacking. So what you need is your diplomats to have an idea of what the Iraqi mood is. They couldn't obviously tell exactly what Saddam Hussein was doing. They couldn't understand what was going on in the inner circle. But that was one thing that you needed to know, and the diplomats couldn't have done that. But the other thing you needed to know in terms of running an occupation is what would the Iraqi mood be? What would the attitude be if we try and run this country for them? If we try and sit there with an open-ended occupation with no terminal date for withdrawal? And I think it's no coincidence that the countries which resumed their embassies after the 1991 Gulf War and therefore had 12 years of experience until 2003, France, Germany and Russia, they all were against the invasion. The two countries, that's the great paradox, which were most keen on the invasion were the ones that had no embassies, no real information, and therefore got it hopelessly wrong. And I don't know if I can make a little commercial before we end this great conversation, but I'm speaking tomorrow at the Strand.
I'll tell everybody about it in a little while.
That's great. No, that's good. Thank you very much.
You say that the Senate Intelligence Committee report suggests that the United States intelligence agencies were actually right in some of their predictions, but wrong on most of them. They were right in the prediction that the building of an Iraqi democracy would be a long, difficult, and turbulent process.
Yes, they were. I mean, the National Intelligence estimate, which came out about a year ago, we understood what it was. It was released under a Freedom of Information Act demand, showed that they could see that there would be problems for the occupiers, and it would run up against Iraqi nationalism, and there would be resistance, and that this was a country that was dominated by deep ethnic and sectarian divisions. So they got some important points right. But even having got those points right, they then said they thought the occupation should last 3 years. So on the crucial decision that flows from the information they had, they got the wrong decision, because I think 3 years would have produced the same trouble that we've had already, even if the occupiers had said we're leaving after 3 years. Most Iraqis would have said that's far too long.
In the intelligence community, what was the general perception of the popularity of political Islam?
Well, they said that it wasn't popular. They didn't understand that. And that was the other great failing, I think, and it was shared by the British so-called experts and officials. They thought that whoever came to power once Saddam was toppled would be a secular person. They misunderstood the great strength of the Shia Islamists who are now running the government, and of course some of them are quite closely connected to Iran, and so Iran ends up as the real people who've become strategic victors of this war, while the British and the Americans with their wrong predictions have really suffered a major political defeat.
Among the most criticized segments of our society as a result of what's going on has been the press. The feeling was that the press really did not look into all the consequences in advance, did not spell out what was going on in advance. You were writing for The Guardian. Were you pressured along with others to go along with what was happening?
Well, we had the famous dossier in Britain, the Downing Street dossier, which came out, which produced the sort of justification for the war. And I think most people reported that, most British newspapers reported that, as though it was an accurate document. It was really only a few reporters and a few media outlets that raised serious questions about it. And the British government ran a very, very effective media campaign with huge headlines implying that Saddam was an imminent threat, that within 45 minutes weapons of mass destruction could hit British bases in Cyprus and throughout the Middle East, parts of NATO and so on. And very few people really questioned that.
And is the Labour Party suffering as a result? Perhaps it's been protected by the fact that the Conservative Party went along with all of that.
Now, that's true. I think that's what's protected them. But right now, the Conservatives have changed their line, at least on one major point, is that they want an inquiry into the run-up to the war as to why all these mistakes were made. and the Liberal Party, which is the third party, is also pushing for that. No, I think the interesting thing, actually, there's a contrast between Britain and the United States on this. I think within your Democratic Party, there is a great deal of soul-searching, and people are being asked to justify, like Senator Clinton, for example, why they voted as they did in 2002, and John Kerry, when he was running 4 years ago, had the same issues, and John Edwards has accepted that he got it wrong, and so on. In Britain, there isn't the same moral sort of pressure within the Labour Party on the people who are in the cabinet, Gordon Brown and others, saying, well, why did you get it wrong? Are you not sorry? Do you not now recognise you made a mistake? The standard line in Britain is almost a form of censorship. Brown and the Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, say, well, we had honest disagreements before the war, but now let's move on. In other words, don't talk about it.
When you go there, do you embed with troops, or do you stay in the green zone as much as possible?
No, I stay in a hotel outside the green zone. It's called the Hamra Hotel, where some other journalists stay. And it's pretty well protected in terms of blast walls and security, and the cars are checked. And they look under the cars with mirrors and things to check that they're not carrying a bomb. But no, I'm not in the green zone, and I have been embedded once or twice. But I find that's useful, the embedding, to give you an idea of what the US military is doing, but it doesn't give you any idea of what Iraqis are thinking. And I think the real story in Iraq is what Iraqis are thinking, and what the government is thinking, what the ordinary people are thinking, and what the resistance movements are thinking. And of course, most of the polls that are conducted show that a majority of Iraqis want the occupation to end as soon as possible.
Jonathan Steele is the author of a number of different books on Russia, on the Soviet Union, in fact, also on Germany, on Eastern Europe, on South Africa, his most recent, based on his reporting on the Iraq War since its inception, is Defeat, Why America and Britain Lost Iraq. It is published by Counterpoint. Thank you so much for being with us today.